Il 15 luglio 2008 siamo saliti al centro di ecologia alpina sul Monte Bondone, sopra Trento, a 1500 metri di altezza. Abbiamo incontrato Chris Watson, artista e sound recordist inglese, che lì ha registrato Cima Verde, un lavoro sonoro e CD realizzato per il progetto Sound Threshold di Daniela Cascella e Lucia Farinati. Con lui abbiamo parlato di suono, qualità acustica del paesaggio e ovviamente del suo lavoro per Cima Verde. L'intervista è in inglese.
I was invited by Daniela and Lucia from Sound Threshold to come here to Chelp up in the mountains above Rovereto to come and listen and to record a project for Sound Thresholds about the sound and music and rhythms and atmospheres of this place. As I've known Daniela a long time and Lucia more recently, and we were both interested in this idea of sort of what characterizes the spirit of a place, and I think we both believe that you can capture that in sound. There's a sort of an essence, part of the fundamental sound of a place is something you can record and then play back and maybe recreate this idea of a spirit of a place. So we'd had these discussions, and then Daniela and Lucia started working here at Chelp with Alessandro Greta about this project, and so I then got invited to come on a residency, and I was asked when I would like to come here, and I thought it'd be interesting to come at a changing time of year when the sounds and the place is in transition. So when I came here at the end of April and early May, there was still a lot of snow. Where we're sitting now, there was 20 centimetres of snow. It wasn't hot and beautiful and warm, sunny like it is today. The weather was good, but it was still quite cold. And the snow was melting out. And one of the first things I realised up here is that there's a particular quality to the sound, whether it's to do with the altitude and the way sound travels through air at this altitude, but it had a very special characteristic. And there was very little, apart from today when there's a mower, there was very little noise pollution here, and I thought it was a particularly special place. There are very few places left in Europe that can be as quiet and as acoustically interesting as this place. Because it's so high, we don't hear the traffic from the autostrada down in the valley. There's very little man-made human sounds. There's some air traffic, but generally the sound here is crystal clear, has a clarity and a depth to it. You can hear into the background. You can hear fundamental sounds that are quite often masked by everyday noise. So I was really interested in capturing that. It's something I believe should be guarded and conserved in the same way that this habitat's looked after. We should look after our acoustic, sonic habitats, because once they're gone, they're destroyed. So I was interested in documenting, capturing that. At that moment in time, that sense of transition. And I was sat here at this table, and I could hear the snow melting. I was fascinated by that. So I used very tiny microphones, like the ones you see clipped to newsreaders on television every night. And I always believe there's much more interesting places to put these microphones rather than on people. So I just lay them on the surface of the snow and recorded this very gentle crackling and release of air bubbles as the snow melted. And this air has maybe been trapped in the snow and ice for years, you know, or certainly from the year before, from when it originally froze. And then all of a sudden is released with this explosion of sound, and the air and the sounds released out of the bubble. So I then got this idea that, in fact, the mountain Cima Verde, which was sat underneath now, which was covered in snow, certainly the top half of it, was contained all the sounds of this area, but they were frozen. They were locked in the snow and the ice, and that during the spring, as the snow melted, the sounds would melt out and be released back into this environment, and along with the water and the sound of the water would then be carried down the mountain and into the valley. So it was part of this annual cycle. So I started to record that, and it was so calm some days that I could stand up on the meadow where the performance is this evening and look at the mountain, Cima Verde. And when it was very quiet, you could hear the wind blowing off the top of that mountain, even though it's a few kilometres away. And there was a fundamental note, almost like a chord of music, that I could hear coming from the mountain. So I made some recordings with very sensitive microphones of that sound, and then I've amplified it for the second track on the CD, which is called Cima Verde, which is the sound of the mountain, and this very low rhythmic sound, which, you know, I believe held captured all the sounds that would be released throughout the spring and the summer. So I started at that very high altitude. I started even above the mountain with the gathering of air, which brings the weather, which has shaped these mountains. Air systems that have come from Northern Europe and from North Africa and meet over the mountains here and mix and merge, which have their own characteristic sound. And then this gradual fallout down the snow and ice onto the mountain and then released eventually into water. So I began this vertical descent in sound from 3,000 meters down the mountainside into this woodland here, where I made some recordings at night, at the very end of the night and the start of the day, because again I was interested in this transitional period and how amazing and remarkable it is to hear, you know, to stand here or sit here as I did from 4 o'clock in the morning, to watch the light change and hear the sound change as the light changes and the, you know, the birds start to sing and the new leaves on the trees start to sing as the breeze sort of takes them. So I made lots of long recordings around sunrise, dawn, and then segued them, overlapped them, overlaid them using this technique which I've been making for some time, like a time compression. So the events of 90 minutes are condensed into about 7, 8, 9 or 10 minutes. So I don't change the sounds, but I overlap them considerably. So you hear remarkably how the sounds of a place change, and that's something else I thought was very dynamic about this place. This going from this beautiful, quite almost sinister aspect of the sounds of the night, where you hear owls way off in the distance, and then things that you can't see, mainly birds, starting to sing from these trees above us. And the whole place then sort of springs to life. Acoustic archaeology was a new term to me. I only heard of it probably about 3 or 4 years ago. And from what I understand of it, because I'm not an acoustic archaeologist, but I'm interested in the ideas. It's historians, researchers, archivists, archaeologists who try and listen back into time to hear what sounds may have existed, or to try and extrapolate out what sounds may have existed. And more interestingly, how people heard sounds and what use they made of them. Because in those days, you know, many centuries ago, many thousands of years ago, we were probably much more in tune acoustically with what went off around us, because it wasn't just some artistic whim, it was a matter of survival. If you could hear what was creeping up on you through the bushes, you wouldn't have to see it if you knew it was going to be a dangerous animal, or you could hear a snake in the grass, or you could hear fire burning, or, you know, anything that was a potential threat or of interest or as a possible resource. We were much more in tune with our environment in that sense. But then, interestingly, to me anyway, I was listening to somebody, a guy called Barry Blesser, who's written a very interesting book called Spaces Speak, Are You Listening? And he talked about the first ever multimedia events. And he's hypothesized that some cave paintings that have been found both in New Mexico and in France are very deep in some caves. And archaeologists over the years could never understand why these cave paintings were in these particular places. And in particular, there were groups of animals like herds of bison or buffalo. And what he believes in, that he suddenly realized, he was visiting one of these caves, that they were in acoustic hotspots, that they were places that had reverberation or special echoes. So in other words, he believed that people would not only make these cave paintings of these animals, groups of animals, they would then mimic the sounds that they would make. And because they were in a very reverberant environment, if they made the sound of animals running, that they could look at the picture and make a sound, or somebody else could make a sound, and they would hear it in this cave, so that the pictures would come to life. So he said, you know, as far as he was concerned, that was the first ever multimedia event. It was probably 40,000 years ago. People making sound creatively and using the sound of their environment to enhance what you could see on the wall, which I found fascinating. And we then start to look in a very different way to ancient people, you know, and regard them, you know, as much more creative than we, you know. Once they got enough food and you got a place to sleep and live safely with your family, you know, people's thoughts then quite often turn to creative functions, such as cave painting, but also to sound as well, which I thought was fascinating. Because he also said that he's found pictures of solitary, predatory animals like panthers and lions and large cats. He said, and those, the paintings of those animals are in places where there's no reverberation, because you don't hear those animals. So the places where there are no echoes, so you just look at it. But places where there are lots of social animals that make a lot of sound, then they would put the paintings somewhere where they could create sound to go with it. When I was recording here at Chell, the first thing I do before recording is listen. So I spent the first 2 days just walking around with no equipment, but just listening to the place and thinking about ways in which I could interpret it. Because I like finding sort of hidden sounds. I don't often just place a microphone on the ground and just record. I try and use the microphone and the headphones in the same way that you use a camera and a viewfinder. So I frame the sonic image in the same way that a camera person would frame a visual image in a viewfinder. So I go around carefully putting the microphone and listening. If I don't like it, I move. And I try and create a balance in the original recording. I don't record 24 hours. I record sort of 10-minute sections, because it takes a lot of time to listen to and edit. And because I record so much, I'm much more selective now in what I choose to record. So, you know, the starting and stopping is part of the process for me, you know, knowing when to start and when to stop. I try and make that as intuitive as I can. But then also, I then started to go down the hill. So I went with Daniela and Lucio. We went to some different forests, because the habitat here is fantastic. It changes very quickly as you go down. We went down the mountain and into a different forest and recorded during the same period there, and then even further down. And I ended up going out in the middle of the night around some vineyards and orchards at just 250 metres above sea level near Garda Lake, recording nightingales, this bird that sings these really beautiful solos at night, and then gets swamped by the dawn chorus in the morning when all the other birds start to sing. And that concluded the whole piece. That was the end of the journey from 3,000 metres to 250 metres. It's interesting. People aren't looking for silence, because silence, the silence that you hear, or you in like being in an anechoic chamber where there is no sound, that's like torture. It's like sensory deprivation, and it's very alien to us, and it would drive you mad if you were locked in a room, an anechoic chamber, for an hour where there was no sound. You can't stand it. It's like one of the worst forms of torture. What we seek, I think, as humans, is a sense of tranquility in a soundtrack, which is exactly what we're hearing now. It's not the absence of sound, it's a background layer upon which we can rest our thoughts and other sounds. Like at the moment, we can hear the sounds through this birch tree, just of the leaves very sort of gently blowing. We've got that as a reference, so it doesn't impinge upon our thoughts and other ideas or other sounds, but it's a background, and it's important to have that in your life, you know, be able to, it gives you a very strong creative focus if you're problem solving or making a painting or a piece of music or whatever, you know. It's, that's why those sounds are important. They sound very simple and basic, but they perform a very important psychological function. Ultrasound just interests me because, you know, we believe, you know, as humans that we're, you know, we can enjoy sort of all aspects of sound, but in fact we live within a very small, narrow frequency band of sound from about 20 hertz to 20 kilohertz. But in fact there's a whole range of sounds outside of that which we're not party to. At the moment around us now there are insects singing, grasshoppers are singing, and we can just hear the very lowest notes. But in fact the strongest and loudest part of the song is ultrasonic, and it's beyond our frequency of hearing. So we can't hear it, but in fact the air is full of insect voices at the moment. And there are devices which enable us to listen to that, those ultrasonic sounds, and I've become interested in, you know, working in the ultrasonic realm and the infrasonic realm, and then by technical processes of pitch changing and slowing down analog tapes or speeding up analog tapes, you can bring those sounds to within our spectrum of hearing, and it, again, it opens up a whole new world. It's just fascinating. And I like that idea that we're being constantly bathed in sound, even though we're not always aware of it. I mean, here it's fine, but in fact you go and work in a building where it can be very bad and make you ill, and I'm sure things like SAD, you know, this seasonal adjusted disorder, and people that suffer from this, it's called sick building syndrome. It's because they're subjected, they're bombarded daily in their offices and place of work by low frequency sounds from air conditioning and fans and all sorts of mechanical sounds, which we're not, and the sound of a building vibrating, which we may not be aware of. But if you spend a lot of time in there, it will make you feel uncomfortable, and eventually it will make you ill. And there's a lot of work that needs to be done by architects in particular into the planning and designing the acoustic spaces in which we work. And we're only really just starting to discover that. I have to choose equipment carefully because one of the first things, the priority is that it's reliable in hostile climates. So some studio equipment is very good and sounds beautiful, but it doesn't work outside. So over the years I've had to find microphones which work, are very good, but also work well outside, and also cables and recorders. So it must be robust. It's got to be simple because I have to carry it, and basic because I have to carry everything myself everywhere, so it needs to be, you know, fairly lightweight. I mean, it never is lightweight, but you know, I have to be careful with what I carry, so you know, I can't take too much. And the recorders, you know, need to be very robust and also very efficient with the current, so they don't use lots of battery power. But it changes really. At the moment I'm using a lot of Sennheiser microphones, and I have a mixer and which is made by a company called SQN in Britain on the Isle of Man. And I use a recorder that's made in America by a company called Sound Devices. I use that because it's a four-channel recorder, which enables me to record surround sound. So I record surround sound by recording using a system called middle and side, or mono and side, which you might know of. And I use a back-to-back system. So with three microphones, you can get four channels, which is great for me, because it means I don't have to carry four microphones.
Radiopapesse.org